We are right in the middle of looking at the great Sermon on the Mount and what Jesus Christ taught us in that great sermon. And we're going to jump into the middle of that at verse 27. So Luke chapter 6, verse number 27. But I say unto you which hear, love your enemies, do good to them which hate you, bless them that curse you, and pray for them which despitefully use you. And to him that smiteth thee on the one cheek, offer also the other. And him that taketh away thy cloak, forbid not to take thy coat also. Give to every man that asketh of thee. And of him that taketh away thy goods, ask them not again. And as ye would that men should do to you, do ye also to them likewise. For if ye love them which love you, what thank have ye? For sinners also love those that love them. And if ye do good to them which do good to you, what thank have ye? For sinners also do even the same. And if ye lend to them of whom ye hope to receive, what thank have ye? For sinners also lend to sinners to receive as much again. But love your enemies and do good and lend hoping for nothing again. And your reward shall be great. And ye shall be the children of the highest, for he is kind unto the unthankful and to the evil. Be ye therefore merciful, as your Father also is merciful. Gospel of Luke chapter number 6. We've got something worth living for. And he has changed our lives. And we want to learn some things about that this morning that are very challenging to the Christian life. This thing of loving our enemies. Luke chapter number 6 in your Bibles this morning. Let's talk for a few moments about one of the greatest missionary stories of the last 100 years. This is the story of the five missionaries who were seeking to make contact with a brutal tribe in the country of Ecuador back in the 1950s. They're commonly called the Auca Indians, although that's not the name of their tribe. As a matter of fact, the word Auca means naked savage. So it's probably not what you would want to call them as a tribe if you were to meet them. But they are known as the Waorani or Wahadani tribe. And a number of missionaries back in the 1950s were burdened to get the gospel to this brutal tribe that nobody had ever had communication with, who lived in the jungles of Ecuador. And there was no language. They had no language to learn. There was no written language. They were just a tribe deep in the jungles who murdered and brutal in their murder of one another, the tribal warfare and whatnot. And so some missionaries had a burden to take the gospel to these people. And you probably know the story through the books. Through Gates of Splendor, that was written by the wife of one of those five missionary men. His name was Jim Elliot. His wife, Elizabeth Elliot, wrote the book Through Gates of Splendor. Or you may know it through the movie, The End of the Spear, that was produced, was written, and it may have been a book before it was a movie, but Steve Saint, the son of one of the missionaries, actually the son of the pilot, one of the five missionaries that were involved in that effort. Steve was just a little boy, a very young boy, when his dad, his mom, and his sister, himself, they went to the jungles of Ecuador, And he was just a little boy when his dad was murdered by the people that they were trying to reach. Here's a picture of the five men that were martyred that day in 1956. And Roger Yoderian, Pete Fleming, Jim Elliott, the husband of Elizabeth Elliott, who went on to write the book Through Gates of Splendor, and just died last year. She died in 2015 in her late 80s here in the United States. Nate Saint, who was the pilot, and his son Steve is the one who was behind the end of the spear, and Ed McCulley. These five men were a part of the team. They were the main team that were trying to reach this very vicious tribe with the gospel of Jesus Christ, and they were all martyred there on along the river in the sandy beach area along the river where they landed their plane, and they were making inroads, and they had great hopes and aspirations that they were going to be successful in reaching these people with the gospel. Nate Saint had a sister. Here's Nate and his wife, Marjorie, and the plane that Nate flew, that flew the missions and flew the team in, and they were making contact. They were meeting with the people. Even took at least one of the tribal people up in the airplane. Of course, they couldn't communicate. They couldn't talk. There was no alphabet. There was no language, written language. And so they were just in the early stages of trying to build a relationship, gain trust, and be able to reach these people with the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so this is Nate and Marjorie. Now, Nate had a sister. I think it's on the next slide. I've lost where my slides are here. Rachel Saint was the sister to Nate Saint. After the men were martyred, they're murdered there in Ecuador, the family were burdened for these people. They were burdened for the murderers of their husbands. And they continued to work to be able to build a relationship and get the gospel to this tribe in the jungles. And so this is an older picture of Rachel Saint. And she was the sister to Nate Saint, and after he was murdered, she became burdened to continue the work, and so she moved into the jungles of Ecuador, and she worked for years. She died as an older lady, and she died in Ecuador, and she gave the rest of her life — this is a picture of her later on in life — but she gave the rest of her life to be able to reach those people. Elizabeth Elliott was the wife of one of the men, Jim Elliott, that was murdered. She went with Rachel, and Rachel and Elizabeth went back, and they worked for years to evangelize this tribe, to get the gospel of Jesus Christ to this tribe. And they were successful. That tribe today is a tribe of godly saints who are actively evangelizing other tribes. This is the 50s. So here we are 65 years later, and that tribe is working to evangelize other tribes and plant churches in other tribes. They were eminently successful. This next slide, I believe, picture of Steve. Steve Saint was the little boy when his dad was murdered there in Ecuador. And Steve ended up growing up for a while there, and then back in the States, became a successful businessman here in the States. When his aunt, Rachel, died, she was recognized kind of like a spiritual leader. It was interesting that she would never teach or preach, but she was the only one that knew anything in that tribe. So she would write out sermons and then have men of the tribe read them, because she didn't want them to think that it was appropriate for a woman to be a preacher. And so she was the spiritual leader of the tribe, but she would never stand before the tribe and teach or preach. She would write it all out and have the men of the tribe deliver that. And so she gave her life to evangelize these people. And when she died, the tribe contacted Steve back here in the States, said, your aunt has died. Would you please come? And so he sold the business, or got rid of the business, whatever, ended his business career, took his wife and his children, and they moved to the jungles of Ecuador and gave the a number of years to be able to continue the work that his aunt and his father. This is one of the men from the tribe. His name is Minkea. He's one of the old men in that tribe that Steve is here pictured with. This is one of the great, great missionary stories of the last 100 years of Christian people who loved their enemies. Women who loved the murderers of their husbands. Christians who loved the murderers of their fathers. Christians who loved the murderers of their friends. As a matter of fact, when they finally came in, because they lost radio contact with the plane, when they finally found the plane and found all the dead bodies and found out what had happened, they found that all of their guns were there with them. But rather than kill the ones that were murdering them, they thought it better to go ahead and be martyred rather than kill the ones that they had given their life to reach. And their wives and their children and their friends picked up where they left off. And to this day, those who are known as the Aucca Indians, the tribe is filled with saved people. Because loving enemies is evangelistic. I remind you that in the Sermon on the Mount that we're studying, Jesus just put his team together. And he said, our goal is to be fishers of men. We're putting together a team to evangelize the world. And to that team, whose function is to evangelize, he said, you must love your enemies. Why? Because that's evangelistic. That wins a hearing for the gospel. The purpose of loving one's enemies is to evangelize one's enemies. It's to reach one's enemies with the gospels. And 65 years ago, 5 men were murdered. And what happened in the aftermath has resulted in the great evangelistic activity in the jungles of Ecuador because some Christians were Christian. They didn't retaliate. They didn't get angry and hope that those murderers die and go to hell. They were burdened for their souls. And they gave their lives to reach those murderers with the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's what Jesus is talking about in the Sermon on the Mount. So I've got to ask us the question, what would make those wives go back, those sisters, those children go back? What would make them go back and love the very men who murdered their loved ones? Could you love your dad's murderer for the sake of the gospel? Could you love your husband's murderer for the sake of the gospel? If not, you're not the kind of person Jesus is looking for to have on his team. Because he's put together a team of people and he's mentoring them as to how they could be effective on his team. And he says to those who are on his team, you must love your enemies. And that is so unnatural. That is so unhuman. That is so outside the scope of reason that this is a supernatural thing. This is a God thing. This is something that is only possible by the indwelling Spirit of the living God, who redeems and changes a hellbound sinner and makes them just like God so that they begin to love their enemies just like God loves his enemies. And Jesus Christ is mentoring His team on this thing of loving enemies. Now, we've been working our way through this sermon. We've learned that as Jesus Christ is chosen, He put His team together and He gave them a name. Their name wasn't the Denver Broncos or the Patriots or whatever. He gave them a name. And the name He gave His team was the Apostles. That was the name Jesus gave His team. Or He also called them, you find it throughout the Gospels, you'll find it them called the 12. So that's their team name, the 12, or the Apostles. And Jesus has put His team together. And now they're in the locker room, and He's coaching them. He's mentoring them. He is developing them so that they can be effective team players on His team. They got to know the offense. They got to know the defense. They got to know the plays. They got to understand, and they got to all work together as a team. And He's mentoring these disciples to be an effective team that can win the game that Jesus Christ is engaged in. It's the battle for the souls of men all over the world. And Jesus Christ is molding them into an effective team. He identified them. We have seen as we've gone through this passage, we've seen that He expects a certain kind of behavior. And He describes these team players on the basis of how they view themselves. And we went through the Beatitudes. Blessed are the poor, and blessed are those that weep. And it went through, how do you see yourself? We studied those, and we learned that Jesus Christ was identifying His team players, first of all, on the basis of how you view yourself. And that's why the religious people couldn't stand Jesus, because He said to the religious people, you view yourself as good, you view yourself as religious, you view yourself as being okay. And He pronounced woes on them, and He said, you're on your way to hell. And then He said to wicked sinners, prostitutes and publicans and thieves, He said, how do you view yourself? Do you see yourself as a sinner deserving hell? Then you're a prime candidate to be on my team. You can get born again. Because you see yourself as in need of a Savior who will redeem you and save you. Religious people aren't qualified to be on the team because they don't see themselves as sinners. So we looked at how Jesus described them on the basis of how they view themselves. But now we're looking at how Jesus Christ is describing His team on the basis of how they view others. Do you love your enemies? How do you view your enemies? How do you view those who despitefully use you? How do you view those who curse you? And Jesus Christ on His team is expecting a character of compassion for people who haven't earned that compassion. He said any sinner can love the people that love them. What special is that? Anyone can do that. Anyone can be nice to the people that are nice to them. But Jesus said, I expect you to have a relationship with the people who hate you, who abuse you, who curse you. Here's what I expect you to do. I expect you to love them. That's attitude. I expect you to do good things for them. That's actions. I expect for you to speak well of them. That's speech. And I expect you to pray for them. That's appealing to God on their behalf. And so Jesus Christ is expecting a character behavior from His team players that requires a supernatural transformation that the Bible calls salvation. And then we also looked at that Jesus Christ, after He talked about this expected behavior out of His team players, we saw how He boiled it down into a principle. One simple principle. We call it the golden rule. You see it in verse number 31 in the text. The principle is, and as ye would that men should do to you, do ye also to them likewise. Not treat people according to how they treat you, but treat people according to how you would want them to treat you if the roles were reversed. And so He boiled this down into a principle of life that we call the golden rule. And then we've also seen how that Jesus Christ expressed to us what ought to motivate us to live this kind of charactered life of loving our enemies. How we should what should motivate us to live this kind of a life that we treat people not on the basis of how they treat us, but we treat people on the basis of how we would want them to treat us if the roles were reversed. And Jesus Christ said, let me tell you what ought to motivate you for this. This is the way I am. And I expect you to be just like me. I'm kind to the unthankful and the evil. And so if you're going to call yourself a Christ-like one, a Christian, if you're going to say that you're like Jesus, if you're a follower of Jesus, patterning your life after the life of Jesus, then you must become who I am. You must be what I am. You must act like I act. You must be motivated to love your enemies because your God loves His enemies. Now, that's kind of the flow of what this passage that we've been kind of chewing on. I want you to notice something just a little bit further. And I want you to realize that this bizarre behavior, this impossible behavior, this supernatural behavior is expected on your worst days. As a matter of fact, the reality of your character is revealed on your really bad days. You know the bad hair days? The days when nothing goes right? The days when everything goes wrong? That's when the real you is manifested. And that's where your unsaved co-workers and neighbors and family need to see the reality of God in you on your worst days, when everything has gone wrong and people are your enemies and they abuse you and they curse you and they do wrong to you. And on your worst day, that's where the reality of who you are comes to the surface, and the world can say, you are like God. You're a Christian. And that's key to evangelizing the lost. They must see the reality of our experience with Christ. Now, you see on your little note, didn't even put any blanks on it for you today. Four statements. These are four experiences. These are your four bad hair days. These are the worst days of your life when the reality of your character must be seen. We pick up in verse 29, and unto him that see what he's done. He said in verse 27, love your enemies, do good to them that hate you, bless them that curse you, pray for them which despitefully use you. He's kind of given them this is what I expect out of you if you're going to be on my team. If you're going to be my team player, this is what I expect. And then he gives them some real life experiences. He gives them some illustrations. Some real life experiences. This is where I want to see this on these days. And he throws out four real life bad hair days. This is when I want you to love your enemies. The first one is when you're insulted. Verse number 29 says, unto him that smiteth thee on the one cheek, offer also the other. What is that all about? The slap on the cheek. This is not a wooden statement of an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, or, you know, what someone does something to you, instead of doing it back to them, just let them do it to you again, and you get mugged in the alley, and they're kicking you, and you say, kick me again. What an opportunity. Kick me again. Now, what's he saying? Turn your other cheek. Jesus, to slap one on the cheek was an insult. It was a way of putting somebody down. It's a way of dishonoring a person. You know, the Apostle Paul talked about how that five times he was kicked out of the synagogues that he went in to preach Christ. And he was hit with whips when he was driven out of the synagogue. You're not welcome in this synagogue anymore, Paul. We don't like what you're preaching. You're not welcome here anymore. And to be desynagogued, to be kicked out of a social group, to be not allowed in the club anymore, to be put out of the club that of your peers, because of your Christianity, because of what you believe, because you still believe that marriage is for a man and a woman. You're not allowed in the club anymore because of what you believe. Because of your Christianity, you're pushed away. And as they push you away, they slap you on the cheek. They insult you, you Christian. I can't believe someone of your stature would actually believe what God said in the Bible. I didn't know there was anyone like you anymore. You actually believe what the Bible says is some kind of authoritative for all time? Where did you come from? I didn't know there were anyone like you around here anymore. Please don't vote. And they slap you for your Christianity. Jesus said, don't retaliate. Don't smart off back to them. Don't give them a piece of your mind. Don't put them in their place. Let them insult you again. And love them while they're doing it. Buy them a gift. Do good to them that hate you. Buy them a gift while they're kicking you out of the club at work. They don't let you sit at the lunch table anymore because they can't believe that you still believe what you believe. And so, instead of retaliating, let them insult you again while you buy them a gift, while you speak well of them to somebody in the next office over. And then get on your knees and pray and appeal to God for their well-being, that God will work in their life. It's four things Jesus said. Love them, do good to them, speak well of them, and appeal to God for them. Pray for them. So this is what we're to do when we're insulted over our Christianity. You say, that's not what I feel like doing. I know, but that's the whole point. Any unsaved person can dish out like behavior. You hit me, I'll hit you. You insult me, I'll insult you. You tell me off, I'll tell you off. Any unsaved person can treat people the way they've been treated. It takes a Christ-like one to be insulted and turn around and buy them a Starbucks gift card and tell them you're praying for them. But Jesus said on your worst days, when you are insulted for your Christianity, let them insult you again rather than retaliate. Wow. Here's a second life experience. Verse number 29 says at the middle of the verse, he said, and him that taketh away thy cloak, forbid not to take thy coat also. What's that all about? Well, they didn't have a whole wardrobe with, you know, a matching coat for every outfit. Do I want my long coat, my short coat? Do I want my coat with the brown color or my coat with the black collar? You know, which outfit? They had the clothes they had on their back, and they had a coat to put on at night. The coat they put on at night was called a cloak. And the garment that they would wear underneath the coat was called their coat in the text. And the Levitical law, the book of Exodus, even gives a specific instruction in Exodus 22 that if you take someone's outer garment, their cloak, as a pledge, you know, as a guarantee that they're going to come back and do what they said they were going to do, and you take their cloak as a pledge that they're going to do what they said they were going to do, don't keep their pledge past sundown. Get this thing sorted out before it gets cold tonight, and then give them back their cloak, or else they won't have anything to put on them while they're sleeping to stay warm. You see, it was a common thing in that culture that one cloak that they owned, it was kind of like the blanket and the coat and whatever, all wrapped up in one, and that's what gave you comfort at night and kept you warm at night. That was essential. But as a manner of persecution, the early believers were in situations where the enemies, the people that despised them for their Christianity, who didn't like what they believed and what they preached, what they witnessed, as a persecution, they would take away their cloak and leave it, not give it back to him at the end of the day. And so they would be deprived of the comfort of for the night. And Jesus Christ says, on a bad day, when the person that doesn't like you takes away your cloak, and they won't give it back to you, and you're going to have to spend all night in the cold, and you're not going to have anything to keep you warm. Let me tell you what I want you to do. If you're going to be on my team, let me tell you what I want you to do. I don't want you to get mad. I don't want you to demand your rights. I want you to love them, buy them a gift, speak well of them, and appeal to God that God will work in their lives and save their souls. And all the while that you're doing that, if they want to take your shirt too, let them have your shirt too. This thing of loving your enemies blows you away. How could anyone, on the day when I'm being deprived of that which I have the right to keep me comfortable, how could I not retaliate and get angry when it's taken away from me because of what I believe, because of what I preach, because of what I testify? How could I not be angry? Jesus said, I tell you what, your love of people who are depriving you of your comfort will be brought back to their mind when they put their head on their pillow tonight, and they're warm, and they know you're not, and they know that you spoke nicely to them as you walked out the door and left a flower with a Starbucks card on it. And they're going to go home and say, I don't get that person. There's something different about that person. I can't understand that person. And it's because they're unsaved. They don't have God living in them. And so when they see God in you, see, this is evangelism. This is reaching the lost with the gospel. Here's a third life experience. Verse number 30. Verse number 30 says, give to every man that asketh of thee. Give to every man that asketh of thee. What is that all about? Well, people, you know, the Christian people were known to be, they were known to be generous, kind, loving their enemies, doing good to people. And so they were the first one to go, I have a need. Would you give me this? Would you give me that? Would you let me have this? Would you let me have that? And Jesus said, you know, when people come to you and they want what you've got, and they ask you, and it's obvious that you're being used. They don't go to your neighbor and ask for all that stuff. They're targeting you because they know you're a Christian and you're generous and you're kind-hearted. And so they use you and they use you and they use you. Jesus said, let me tell you what I want you to do. When you feel that you're being used by someone at work, when you feel like you're being used by someone in the community, here's what I want you to do. I want you to love them. I want you to buy them a gift. I want you to tell somebody what a wonderful person that person is that's using you. And I want you to get on your knees and say, oh God, would you show your reality to this person? Save their souls. On the day when you're feeling used, you see, this is getting into material possessions, but material possessions are only temporal. But the real value of material possessions is not your use of them for your comfort. The real value of the material possessions at your home and in your bank account is for using them to extend Christ's kingdom. And if you can have a loose hand on material things, even when the unsaved are using you, and you give to them anyway, while you love them and pray for them, that's using material possessions for Christ's kingdom, to further the gospel in the lives of unsaved people who've never met anyone like you before. You are so different because of the presence of God in your life. Here's the last one. Verse number 30 has the fourth life experience. Verse number 30 in the middle of the verse says, "And of him that taketh away thy goods, ask them not again." Wow. You mean if they rob me? You mean if they break in my home and take my stuff? Wow. Jesus, are you serious? When they take my stuff, I'm not to ask to get them back? Whoa. When I'm robbed by my enemies and looted my possessions? You know, in recent years here in America, some Christians have been robbed by our government of their possessions because they didn't believe it was right for a man and a man, for a woman and a woman to marry, so they wouldn't bake the cake and they wouldn't take the pictures. The government stepped in and stole their possessions through fines. And because of their belief, their goods were stolen from them by our governmental system. And Jesus says, let me tell you what America needs. America needs some real Christians. Not Christians in name only. You know, the rhinos, Republican in name only. Not the Christians in name only. The ones who act like unsaved people, but they say they're saved people. What America needs is some real Christians. Some real Christians who live what Jesus said he requires out of his team players. So that when the world sees our abuse and they see the smile on our face, they get our gift in the mail, they hear a rumor that we were talking nice about them, and all of a sudden they realize there's something really wrong with their lives because they met a real, honest to goodness, bona fide, real Christian. And they've never met one of those before. When they steal your stuff because of what you believe, don't get angry. Don't retaliate. Don't take them to court to get your stuff back. Don't pursue the law to the extent that you can do so. He said, I'll tell you what I want you to do. Don't even ask for the stuff back. You know, our Baptist forefathers had their stuff stolen here in Virginia by the government in the colonial days because they were Baptists, when it was illegal to be a Baptist in Virginia. Their farms were taken, their crops were taken, stuff was stolen. You know, for 2,000 years in Christianity, Christians have always been persecuted by having their stuff stolen by those who despise Christianity. And Jesus' answer is, don't retaliate. Don't get angry. This is a great soul-winning opportunity. This is a great evangelistic opportunity. Do what God would do to win the opportunity to evangelize somebody that needs to know the gospel of Jesus Christ. So what's Jesus talking about? He's talking about on our bad days, when we are insulted and deprived of comfort, when we're used and when we're robbed, we need to learn how to love those enemies and to do good to those who hate us and pray for those who curse us, bless those who curse us and pray for those who despitefully use us. Because that's what Jesus' team does to win the world to Jesus Christ. And that's what it takes for evangelism to be effective. Let me tell you a little bit of the rest of this story here. Here's that slide of Steve again. Steve and Minkay. Steve was just a little boy when his dad was murdered. And his life revolved around his dad. He so missed his dad. Ripped out of his life by a murderer. Steve grew up wishing he had a dad. And then Steve got married and became a dad. And then he began to long for for his kids to know their granddad. You know, my dad died when Chad was just 2 years old. My son Aaron, second son Aaron, was just a couple of months old. And I remember laying in bed that night, all night long, crying. The night my dad died. Thinking, Chad's not going to know his granddad. Aaron's not going to know his granddad. My kids are never going to know the most important man in my life. And I cried. That's kind of how Steve felt. Only it was different with Steve. My dad wasn't viciously murdered. Steve's dad was viciously murdered. You know how he wanted his kids to know their granddad. Years later, when Steve went back to Ecuador, and his kids were at ages where they needed a granddad, there was an old man in the tribe. His name was Minkaya. And he was kind of an old guy, maybe the oldest man in the tribe. He was kind of a grandfatherly kind of a guy. He was also the man that murdered Steve's dad. He was Steve's dad's murderer. And Steve's kids, since their granddad had been murdered, they adopted Minkaya to be their granddad. And so the man that murdered their granddad became their granddad. And they loved him. And he loved Steve's kids. And when Steve's eldest son graduated from high school back in the States, Steve asked his son, "Son, what would you like for a graduation from high school gift?" He says, "Dad, more than anything in this world, I would like for Grandpa to somehow be able to be gotten out of the jungles of Ecuador and come to my graduation here in America." How do you get a man without a passport and no paperwork? How do you get a man out of the jungles of Ecuador into the United States? But they did. And he attended the graduation as the honored guest, the grandfather of Steve's kids. And he's the very man that murdered their grandfather. Could I say to you that loving your enemies is all about evangelism? It's not about you and your feelings and what you want. It's about the eternal souls of men. Do you understand Jesus Christ? Have you ever understood what he taught? What he expects out of us? What he empowers us to be able to become as forgiving, loving people who in the extreme would even forgive the ones who hate us for the sake of the gospel in the lives of unsaved people. Can you forgive your enemies? Can you buy them a gift this week? Can you speak well of them to somebody else? Can you appeal to God to bless them while they are abusing you?